From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In 1968, just as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was launching his ambitious and powerful Poor People's Campaign, he was assassinated, and his broad-based intersectional activism cut short. The Poor People's Campaign continued under the leadership of others in the movement. And today, as inequality soars in the United States and globally, a new generation of activists has revived the idea behind the original Poor People's Campaign and applied it to modern conditions. As we continue our special reporting from Into Action, the pop-up art exhibit and conference in Los Angeles, we turn now to one of the founders of the just-launched Poor People's Campaign.
My name is Kate Ziegler. I am one of the four co-chairs of California's Poor People Campaign, a national call for moral revival.
And what is the Poor People's Campaign? It has a name that suggests a historical significance.
It absolutely does. While it's so important to honor the legacy, which is part of this installation behind us, of the first one that was started by so many leaders and headed also by MLK Jr. in 68, what we're doing is we're reviving it and not just commemorating it. And it's something that's been building almost a decade in the making, a fusion coalition that started as something called Moral Mondays in North Carolina, led by Dr. Reverend William Barber and many other clergy members across different faiths. And now it's spread out across the entire nation, and dozens of states have started their own statewide Poor People's Campaigns, which together forms a national fusion coalition of grassroots organizations and impacted poor folks and community members who are suffering from extreme poverty.
So describe the installation we're standing in front of.
So this is an art installation which is trying to pay respect to the movement of the first campaign, which wasn't able to be have all of its goals fully achieved. And the three demands of 68 for the first campaign, just so everyone knows how radical it was universal basic income, 500,000 affordable housing units per year until slums were eliminated, and a $30 billion anti-poverty bill. So none of those goals were achieved, but that's what they were protesting for, a radical shift congressionally of how poverty was dealt with in America. So there was a group of people from Marks, Mississippi, that were mainly black and brown folks that were in the poorest county, in the poorest town, in the poorest state in 68. And they took a mule train with covered wagons, and they went for a month ambling through the South with slogans like this. And then they went to go protest in Washington, D.C. on the lawn of the National Mall in something called Resurrection City.
And the slogan for our radio audience is, "We have a dream, and it's not colonialism."
Yes, and I would just like to say that something so amazing about this art is being able to engage in dialogue, especially to understand how we truly build a fusion coalition. And we just had this incredible talk with two indigenous leaders over there. And what we were talking about was that the covered wagon actually is directly triggering and can be offensive to the native and indigenous population because it represents colonialization and settlement. And we didn't fully know that going into this, but the campaign actually does speak and speak to the oppression of indigenous people. So I just added this line not 5 minutes ago, because it's not
a line that says, "and it's not colonialism." So initially the wagon just said, "We have a dream," and you added the other line.
Right, because it's important that if we're actually trying to build a true and authentic intersection of all the races who are affected by racism, poverty, the war economy, and environmental devastation, it's so important to get not only the black perspective or the Asian perspective or the indigenous perspective, but all of them. So this is an installation now trying to honor a slogan that actually really honors everyone.
Right, because the wagon brings up this the pioneer manifest destiny and all of that baggage.
Absolutely, and that was never the intention, and it was actually something opposite. So to really know that even when we have our intentions being brought forth of how to create a better and more sustainable art for a better sustainable future, we need to really understand what are all the opinions, what are all the community's traumas. And something so powerful about being in this space, and I have such honor to be here, is that just like in the gallery where there are all these trigger warnings and there's photography of lynchings and there's bullets, and just like this wagon, so many people are triggered by different things, which really just speaks to that we live in a nation where so many things and so many traumas affect every person, especially minorities, and that's really the largest issue at hand. we shouldn't live in a world and a future for our children where everything is triggering because our past is so lined with complexity upon complexity of trauma, mainly because of policy that's racist.
So how does the Poor People's Campaign of today try to uphold the legacy of the original Poor People's Campaign? Have the demands evolved, or are they at their core the same?
So the pillars of the campaign directly respect and honor the legacy and the work of the civil rights era. The three pillars of the first campaign were racism, poverty, and the war economy, which was when Martin Luther King Jr. started talking about in Beyond Vietnam that the war was really tied into why people suffer at home and are living in poverty. And then in 2018, those three pillars are the same, but there's a fourth one, which is ecological devastation, because at the time, the environment and what was happening was not as known 50 years ago. So the four pillars that every single person joining the Poor People's Campaign across America is bound to are really respecting and honoring the work of the first campaign. And there are also 12 fundamental principles, which are mandatory criteria, which every person joining as a partner, an organization, nationwide or statewide, must agree to, directly are in line with the nonviolent principles of Gandhi, of MLK Jr., and it's about nonviolence not only in civil disobedience, but in the way that we talk, the way that we engage, that everything must be nonviolent or else you can't be part of the campaign. So that feels like it's also directly coming from the lineage of nonviolent action is the best way to affect social and cultural change.
So civil disobedience was very much part of MLK's legacy. It was one of the most effective tools he used. How do you see that tool manifesting today? Do we see that legacy living on, or because police brutality continues today, do people back down?
That's a really great question, and it's a really hard line for a lot of people already in creating this Fusion Coalition and asking so many people who have been affected by police brutality, who have been affected by incarceration or extreme policy that have taken away everything for their family, to ask them to step into civil disobedience that's nonviolent can seem like a lot. But it's so important at the end of the day, no matter what the trauma is, that violence begets violence. That feels truer than ever. Even myself as an activist and an organizer, it is very natural and it's honored that we have trauma and that we shouldn't be passive and that we shouldn't just let things happen to us. But true nonviolence is a way of life. It's actually one of the hardest things that you can do. And nonviolent communication and direct action is a huge part of this campaign, because what we'll be asking for, which is being released from national so it's unified, will come in the next couple months, the demands of the campaign. And they will be asking for huge federal radical change about how poverty is addressed in this country soon and not in 100 years or slowly battle by battle. And if those demands aren't met after this audit comes out from the National Poor People's Campaign, then there will be a season of nonviolent civil disobedience, which every single Poor People's Campaign in every state will strategically organize for at the same time. And starting on Mother's Day of this year, there will be 40 days of civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience, at the state capitol in every single state.
Okay, so we moved to a quieter place, yes, since the music at Into Action was getting pretty loud. So you were telling us about the Mother's Day actions that are going to be planned. And so my question was, how does one achieve those pillars you were talking about? Do you have allies who are in state legislative bodies that will be trying to introduce legislation to further those pillars that then grassroots activists from Poor People's Campaign can push for? How do you envision, what's the strategy?
I would have to say that the strategy is being co-created and developed as the community who wants to be engaged comes in.
It's all very new then.
It's very, very new. Our launch for California and nationwide for the campaign officially was December 4th of 2017. So the speed of which we've been able to organize and get grassroots partners in what, 6 weeks, has been incredible. We already have three regional committees, LA proper, one in San Diego, and one representing right now Northern California, which is breaking off into smaller groups. So we're really trying to, first of all, reach people even before the launch, only that are the affected people. The leadership of this campaign are poor impacted people at the center, and organizers and partners are almost in this larger concentric circle outside, which help to make sure that the voices are being heard. But in terms of pushing anything politically or the agenda, that really would be coming from when more people come in and we can hear what the co-created agenda is from all of our organizations, saying this is what poverty looks like in this area, this is how people are suffering. For example, in LA, for sure, is, you know, immigration and housing and the housing market, and that rent control is barely visible, and these are things that we already know in our organizations that are very important, because it's directly the causality of why people are so poor in LA. So this is already being voiced, and we'll slowly and very meticulously listen and just listen to what people need. But in terms of also working in congruency with politicians, that's something that is not really part of this campaign, and what is different in a new kind of fusion coalition, and that makes this to me more important than ever, is that one of the other 12 fundamental principles of the Poor People's Campaign is that absolutely no politicians or elected officials take the stage and are at the front or even really part of the campaign in terms of promoting or endorsing political figures.
So purely grassroots. Yeah.
Purely grassroots, because it changes when policymakers get involved too soon, and that's not what our aim is. This is supposed to be a movement for the people and not for any type of political season.
So I want to talk about the issue of morality, because that's, of course, what was the basis and what drove Dr. King's vision and the vision of many civil rights leaders. It's what is driving Reverend William Barber in North Carolina with Moral Mondays, literally in the name of the activism that he's doing. Today, the idea of morality has become conflated with the prosperity gospel in evangelical Christian America, and it's what has found a lot of cachet among conservative politicians and even, of course, at the White House. So how do we change conversations around what morality really is in this country? How do we change the very definition and sort of return to the original idea of, you know, morality being something, you know, that's divorced from making money?
Yeah,
and being rich?
That's such a great question, and the answer really is, for me, the Poor People's Campaign and the tools that the Poor People's Campaign has. The most basic and necessary is dialogue, is authentic conversation, especially in meeting the other, and especially seeing that there is such a huge onslaught of conservatives and religious faith leaders in what Barber says is almost committing a sin in co-opting language that's about morality and using it to further policy or decisions that directly are killing and affecting poor people in ways that we couldn't have ever imagined would still be around in the richest nation ever to exist. So a way that each individual, or for me, for example, I can only speak for myself, right? But I help to lead Moral Mondays LA, right? And there are a lot of activists there who, first of all, might be atheist, agnostic, that they have the same feeling of faith that many people do. Like, why should we talk about morality? It's so almost grimy and dirty now because of the way that a lot of clergy mixed with politicians are doing it. And it's much more simple. And you can just say, what feels right? What feels humanistic? What feels like it's really honoring and respecting what your intuition says is right? If you can take away identity politics, or you can take away saying, oh, well, because I'm left or because I'm right, I feel like a blend of this with something like this means that it'll be moral. No, it's like really just take a moment with yourself and say, when I think about poverty, when I think about racism, when I think about slums, when I think about the state of education, healthcare, immigration, gender equality, every single thing in America that is causing us to suffer, even that a lot of people in the middle class are one paycheck away from being in poverty, does that feel right? And if it doesn't, is it moral? And so morality is more talking about, like, do you feel like your human rights are being respected? Do you feel like you're respecting other people's human rights? So for me, it's much more casual. It's not for faith for me. It's very personal, about just talking about what feels right to do to help the other man, to help the other woman, to help the other person.
So morality and the idea of speaking of morality can almost bridge a divide between and undermine the labels of left and right that can often be really polarizing.
I think that's exactly it, and it feels really powerful and invites a deeper conversation to almost even use morality instead of saying something that doesn't initially instigate a response from many that might push them away if they're not of faith or if they even came away from a faith.
In.
It's to draw them in. It can feel maybe instigative at first, and they might say, well, this isn't for me, and then it's actually a conversation to say, let's actually talk about and reclaim the narrative of what morality means. And that's another huge tenet of the Poor People's Campaign, is how do we shift and redefine a new moral narrative that has nothing to do with politics, that has nothing to do with clergy members talking about how money or wealth or this should be distributed, but actually how do we create a better humankind that's equitable, that's kind, where people aren't starving to death or dying because of terrible leadership.
It reminds me of the Washington Post did a really interesting sort of survey recently where they gathered a bunch of Americans together to find out what were the things that unified Americans, because there's so much that divides us today. And of the seven things that they found unified Americans were things like diversity and community, which was really interesting. And these are people, of course, across the political spectrum. So finally, I want to ask you this question of class. The Poor People's Campaign requires low-income Americans, which is a euphemism we use for poor people in this country, to identify as poor, because we have very culturally, we have a cultural anathema towards acknowledging class as something real. In other countries, people have a lot more class consciousness than we do here in the United States. Do you find that because poverty is so widespread today, is so persistent, that more and more people are discovering their class consciousness and are more willing to identify proudly as poor people wanting to come together to demand a better life?
I think I can definitely see a shift, not only from the conversations that I've been having being part of this campaign, but in that also the classes are being redefined, and that now with what under a handful of people own more wealth than more than the bottom half of the world, class feels more unifying than ever, because actually there really is sort of becoming one class and then this extreme 1% of the 1% class. So the unity of realizing that on one hand, almost paradoxically, class matters to unify and show that the way poverty is not being addressed is affecting all of us, also shows that like class almost doesn't exist, because if we don't have anything that's creating wealth and creating jobs and creating reform to make us better, then what does class mean except for some type of old dialogue? So being able to have people come together under just realizing all of us are suffering, and whether you make $100,000 a year or you make $6 an hour, $8 an hour, everyone is truly suffering in the same way. But making sure that the people who are being most negatively affected, the very impoverished people, especially the houseless people in LA, are being in the campaign is one of the hugest parts of this movement. It's not about us talking about poor people. This literally is a movement for people. You know, I'm volunteering my time so I can just amplify the voices of poor people saying this is what they want. I have no idea what someone else that I'm not in the position wants. So it's lifting up the voices of people who have been systematically oppressed for generations.
So how many states has the campaign spread to? Where can people find out more information? Our show is nationwide, so there might be people listening and watching from other parts of the country and might be interested in starting a campaign in their own state.
Yeah, that would be so amazing. So there's a website which is national. It's called poorpeoplescampaign.org. And when you go there, the first page is a sign up where you put in your information digitally, and then wherever you live, you are then put into the state. I don't know the exact number, but there are about, I think, 30 to 35 different states right now that have very autonomously and powerfully started organizing their entire state, just like California has. And we're all connected by these amazing national organizers coming from the national campaign with Dr. Barber, Dr. Theo Harris. Laurel, for example, is this amazing organizer who's organizing us with all the states on the Pacific Coast. And so, you know, we're really connected and also autonomous, because it's important for the states to be able to reclaim their power and what they need while also supporting the national narrative. Everything is on social media for California. If they're in here, they can go to California PPC and get engaged in every state to either participate and sign up for nonviolent civil disobedience and training coming from national, or they can sign up to mobilize or throw house parties in their community. Basically any type of capacity that people want to have and the ability that they have to donate time to the campaign is welcome, no matter what their ability or their time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was so great to meet you. Thank you.
My guest has been Kate Ziegler, co-founder of the California chapter of the Poor People's Campaign, speaking to me at the Into Action pop-up event in Los Angeles. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.